In the small town of Tomskog, Minnesota, there were four handcuffed people lined against a wall. The room smelled like a stale morning dew, and the walls were lined with soldered sheet metal, rusted and forgotten since the early 70s. The four people had been there for several hours, but the sedatives had kept them blissfully unaware. As an old door cracked to life, a man entered the room. He was dressed in green plastic poncho, with a burlap sack covering his face. "Rise and shine," he sighed. "Let's begin." With the flick of a wrist, he lit a road flare. A sparkling red shine burst to life, jolting the four people awake. One by one, they found their bearings, their heads lolling back and forth. The air was stale and tainted with rust. There was a slight pressure in their ears. They might be underground. The man in the burlap sack dropped the flare on the floor and walked up to them one by one. He offered them a merciful splash of water from a canteen, and no one dared to refuse. Ice cold spring water. He stepped back, taking in the sights of these four, to the spattering of the road flare. "I need to know which one of you is Emmett Rask," he said. A strange question. Emmett Rask had been dead for over a century, an obscure man who never managed to strike a large audience with his varied works of plays, novels, and bedtime stories. There were even a few non-fiction, stream of consciousness type books called The Diaries of Emmett Rask out there, focusing mainly on his delirious nighttime philosophies, but they didn't have much of a following. But these four people had a peculiar connection to Emmett Rask, and the man in the burlap sack knew this. He stepped up to the man on the far left, keeping him at arm's reach. "Are you Emmett Rask?" he asked. The man on the far left was Leonard Gamet, 24 years old, plucked from an underground party at the Sauron docks as he went outside to take a piss. Leonard had found success online by producing short videos based on the works of Rask. One film had granted over 2 million views and portrayed the struggle of a man trying to break the circle of violence brought on by his abusive stepfather. In the original story, the stepfather was symbolized with an ever-present eye in the sky, an obvious metaphor of a god complex. In Gamet's adaptation, however, this was symbolized with an addiction to smartphones.
I don't know how... What do you want from me?"
Leonard stammered. The man in the burlap sack observed him for a few seconds. When it became evident that there'd be no answer, he flicked his wrist and produced the handgun. Moments later, a shot rang out in the hollow metal room, deafening the three remaining captives. Leonard's blood just looked like water in the red light of the flare. He looked suit covered, rather than shot. The remaining prisoners screamed and tossed against their chains, but these were custom fitted to suit them. There would be no escape.
"What the heck are you doing?"
cried the second prisoner.
"He wasn't Emmett Rask,"
the man in the burlap sack said.
"Are you?"
The second prisoner was the award-winning novelist, Lawrence St. John. That he was put among these relative nobodies was nothing short of disgrace. This was a man that had toured the world countless times over his 30-year career, taking much of his inspiration from early 20th century writers, and yet he hung from the chains, just like everyone else. Kidnapped, Eddie stepped into a luxurious taxi with a seemingly adoring fan.
Anyone could be Emmett Rask,"
Lawrence said.
That's a central theme in most of his work. The idea that identity is transferable, transcendent."
"Explain,"
demanded the man in the burlap sack.
"It's informal. It can't die. And since we are informative, we can't."
Lawrence paused,
He couldn't think as he stared down the barrel of a gun. His mind locked itself in a corner, forcing him into a mental fetal position. He wavered between the talking points of his recent tour and his desperate pleadings of a dead, threatened man. The man with the burlap sack, however, didn't care either way. He just pulled the trigger. Lawrence joined Gamet as they both hung their heads down low. The shot echoed back and forth, causing the sheet metal walls to hum and dance. The remaining two people tried to blink away the pain in their ears, but there was nothing to be done. Pain was going to take its toll, whether they wanted it or not. Next in line was Sarah Wilson, playwright and director at a community theater in downtown Mankato. Her thick glasses had rolled off the bridge of her nose during her unconscious state, and she couldn't see any details of her assailant through the fog of her glaucoma. And yet, when the barrel of a gun tilted her way, she stood up straight and proud. She was perhaps the most familiar with the works of Emmett Rask, and she could gab with the best of them.
"Are you Emmett Rask?"
the man with the burlap sack asked.
"I could be," she said. "But what makes you think I would tell you if I were?"
"Because if you don't, I will murder you," he responded.
"What is a body, Tony Mortal?"
She smiled. "Explain."
Emmett Rask had the idea that the very essence of a person could be distilled into a select and compact set of words. While genes might be our physical building blocks, determining our physiological being, it is the information we perceive that shape our minds. Sarah knew this, as it was a central theme in her rendition of Rask's play, The Hatchet Man. Rask believed that all language was derivative of a core principle, that we taught ourselves language not only to warn others of danger, but to immoralize ourselves.
"True," said the man in the burlap sack, "but does that make you him?"
"A person who has studied his work for any periods of time carries a piece of him," she continued, "and I have studied him extensively. If I am not him presently, I can become him."
"So in conclusion, you are not currently Emmett Rask."
Sarah held her breath, feeling the warmth of the gun. She looked at the prisoner to her left, a vague shadow staring to wake. A sudden anxiousness blossomed in her chest, the realization that this was really happening. This might be the actual, final end. It could be a matter of seconds. She tasted metal, perhaps from the rusted balls.
"How would you know if anyone is Emmett Rask?"
she asked. "There could be hundreds of people studying his work. In one way or another, if you are so convinced that he is out there, what makes you think he's one of us?"
"I don't," the man in the burlap sack answered. "I will keep killing until I find them."
There'd been the mysterious disappearance of Helen Mori, a librarian at the Livingstone Lord Library. Patrick England, who had been murdered during a home invasion. Johan Dahlen, an exchange student who disappeared on his way back to his dormitory. They had all been avid Rask enthusiasts, and they had all met their fate at the hands of the same man, with the same burlap sack.
"Do you think they are Rask?"
Sarah asked, leaning her head towards the remaining prisoner.
"They haven't said a word. Do you take Rask to be a talkative man, or a quiet one?"
The man in the burlap sack paused. It was a good question. "But I know if it was him, transformation can, in theory, be gradual."
"Explain."
And Sarah explained. In the diaries of Emmett Rask, he rambled about immortality of the soul and the transference of identity. It was a theme in everything he did, in an effort to immortalize himself. It was said that if one were to experience everything he'd written, one would
would be so enamored with him that they would, in time, actually become him. I have read the plays, I have studied the diaries, I have transcribed his novels, and I have reviewed his work countless times, said Sarah. For you to point that tool at me and demand me to explain myself is beyond. A third shot rang out as Sarah Wilson joined her peers, her blood painting the rusted wall. The fourth and final prisoner hung their head, gently rocking themselves awake. Perhaps the sedatives had taken a greater hold than the man in the burlap sack had expected. He sighed, another batch of prisoners, and they were all useless meat. He imagined the many nights ahead when he would have to get rid of the bodies, to burn his clothes and erase all traces of them ever being there. It would be daunting, physical labor, like all the other nights, exhausting. The fourth prisoner raised her head. She forgot, the prisoner said. She forgot the children's books. Hannah Blanchett was, by far, the youngest of the lot. At age 21, she had just started her career making books for children. Some of her early works was heavily inspired by Rask, and she was quite open about it in the few interviews she'd made. But she was far from a scholar or an enthusiast.
Is that bad?
The man in the burlap sack asked. It's the purest form, said Hannah. The purest is storytelling.
It's just bedtime stories about foxes, frogs, and dragons. How can that be pure?
It's not the stories themselves, but how you tell them, Hannah continued. They are told with love to an attentive audience. How many times in your life has someone actually read The Little Red Riding Hood to you?
I don't know.
Yet, you know the story by heart, but can you remember the headline of yesterday's newspaper? Hannah shook herself awake and stood up straight. She tried to blink the sleep out of her eyes, but the red flare was only making things worse. She gave up with a sigh. It's in the children's books that the essence of his being is transmitted, she said. In the frogs, the foxes, and the dragons, that's where he tells his true wants and loves and lessons.
So then, are you Emmett Rask? So then, are you Emmett Rask? He asked.
There was a part of Hannah that wanted to say yes. She wanted to scream it, to convince this madman that she was someone she wasn't, but she really couldn't. She knew who she was. Sure, she'd been read those stories as a kid, but maybe she hadn't picked up on the true meaning. Maybe she'd fallen asleep at the punchline one too many times. Lulled to sleep by her father's silky voice. But she thought about it, and there was something there in the back of her mind. A thought like an old scar that had been burned into her soul, only to shave when remembered. She picked at it. Language, she said. That's what made Rask into what it was.
That goes without saying, scoffed the man in the burlap sack. You can read that on the summary of his books.
Not just the fudging words, you fudging dolt, she spat. The language of touch, taste, the smell, sight and sound. Fudging moths can talk to one another. And you think that just rolls up one out of nothing? You think all we say is food and run? At some point, something, somewhere, taught us to say nightmare, hope, hatred, and screw you? These are all unnatural thoughts, unbefitting of an animal, and yet you and I can speak them with ease. Hannah remembered the story her mother had told her. It wasn't a very good one, but it was one of the first she'd ever heard. It was a fox who went into the woods. He went there to find his forgotten name. Along the way, he met all kinds of friends, and they all helped him look for the name. Together, they looked over the stars, under the stones, and in the heart of a frozen giant. But nowhere did they find the name, no matter how hard they looked. Finally, the fox found solace in his many friends, but he always wondered what his true name might have been. But of course, Hannah knew. She knew the name all along. It was her name and his. The image grabbed her, flinging her up against the wall. In her mind's eye, she saw herself walking the cobblestone streets of San Francisco as electric lights were being put up. She saw herself giving away her daughter, Samantha, at a wedding. She saw herself dressed for the rehearsal of a play. She saw countless early mornings as she shaved the face of a man growing old in the bathroom mirror. Finally, she saw a study, the flutter of two moths playing in the morning sun as her heart failed to beat. And then there was darkness, an endless, reachless void, an impenetrable veil, and night without the stars. And in that space, something reached out for her, welcoming her. Something that had been there all along, teaching her to think, teaching her to read, teaching her to listen, to love, to hope, and to grieve. It was right there, the being that had brought words to the apes and taught them to live. And for the first time, someone came to his throne.
"I see him. I see him," Hannah muttered. I'm feeling him."
The man in the burlap sack watched her rile and contort, her body lifting itself into the air, struggling to break the chains or her wrists, whatever came first. But Hannah saw nothing of the red flare or the slumped bodies. She saw it. It sat upon a veiled throne, crying over the abuse of a gift, a mouth for every man, woman, and child, a body of blackened hearts beating in unison, wailing for us to listen, for us to hear the words of those who wanted more, to do more, and who had their time cut short. But in the darkest space of the in-between, there was no one else. Anna coughed as her eyes rolled back. Her body was trying to physically look inwards, turning her eyes inside out. The streaks of blood rolled out of her nose as the spasm took hold. "The veiled throne cries for us to listen, to read the white of the lines," she shrieked, chewing on her tongue. "We abuse the gift long given. We choose to forgo and fade." She turned her white eyes to the man in the burlap sack. The shadows of the room crept closer as the light of the flare started to die. It too remembered to listen. The walls remembered. The door remembered. It was all coming back to a realization of a universal truth long since forgotten. That information can be transferred infinitely, anywhere. It can never die. All you need is to know the right words. The man in the burlap sack backed away, raising his pistol into the dark. "There is no one left to wander the halls of the void. You have abandoned him. You all abandoned our lord." The walls wept, curling the sheet metal like bad wallpaper. The chains wilted like autumn petals, falling away at her wrists, carried forth by a memory of an earth unbound. An unspoken word, taught in the words beyond, came to her. And from the throne, an undulating form screamed in ecstasy. Finally, the one guest at his side would go to spread his truth. Hannah Blanchett screamed a single word, a word that summarized all that needed to be said into a single sound, forced into the world by a power beyond, a voice reaching through a mortal neck at the cost of a soul freely given. And the man in the burlap sack pulled the trigger. As the fourth prisoner slumped to the floor burned out.
The man with the burlap sack tasted the words he'd heard, feeling them burned into his mind like a fresh tattoo. He removed his mask and stepped out of the room in a daze. He walked up the many flights of stairs that covered his lair and clutched his pistol tight, ignoring the stench of extensive water damage. The night sky was clear and the air was crisp. The many stars above spoke of a truth beyond truths, a resting place of those who truly listened. He knew there was something out there, something that had once given us a way to speak across eons, a language that could bend the world and send us into sights unseen, where one to truly listen. As the man raised his pistol to his temple, he himself asked one final question: am I Emmett Rask? And with the flutter of two moths playing in the night sky, he saw the answer, and no trigger was pulled.